You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Conflict journalist Marie Colvin reported from the most dangerous places in the world. Known for her bravery and compassion, she perpetually pushed her work to the edge. She lost an eye in a grenade blast while on assignment. She had to wear a black eye patch. Marie Colvin was killed while reporting in Syria in 2012. She was 56 years old. Just last week, a court in the U.S. ruled that Colvin's death in 2012 was in fact a, quote, targeted murder, and it ordered the Syrian government to pay $302 million in damages to her family. In her ruling, Judge Amy Berman Jackson wrote, quote, a targeted murder of an American citizen whose courageous work was not only important but vital to our understanding of war zones and of wars generally is outrageous. The judge continued, quote, she was specifically targeted because of her profession for the purpose of silencing those reporting on the growing opposition movement in the country. In a book titled In Extremis, The Life and Death of War Correspondent Marie Colvin, her fellow foreign correspondent Lindsay Hilsum tells the story of a complex woman who sought to bear witness to the horrifying truths of war up until the moment of her tragic death. I spoke to Lindsay about Marie Colvin's life and work last fall. Let's take a listen to that conversation. Lindsay Hilsum is an award-winning journalist and the Channel 4 News International editor, and she joins us now. Hello, Lindsay.
It's a pleasure to be there.
What is unique about Marie's story as a war correspondent that made you want to write a book about her?
Well, I think it's partly personal and it's partly just who she was. I mean, she always went in further and stayed longer. And many of the other correspondents were in awe of her because of that. She got incredible scoops. You know, she was the person who would always get the interview with Gaddafi or Arafat. She was the person who, you know, went into Chechnya during the war and got bombed and then, you know, had an incredibly perilous, epic escape. But also, it just so happened that I was in touch with her a lot in the last couple of weeks of her life. We had dinner in Beirut together. She told me she was going to go into Syria to be smuggled into this besieged enclave. And I said that this is just, you know, beyond my danger threshold. But she went nonetheless.
What does the title of the book refer to?
It was something she wrote. She wrote that she liked to write about people living in extremis and going through the unendurable, and that it's important to tell people what really happens in wars. But the reason I chose the title was because she lived her life in extremis as well. You know, in terms of, you know, she did drink to excess. She didn't really sort of have any barriers. She had, well, if I can say so, terrible taste in men. I mean, she was always in heartbreak. One of the things I learned from reading her diaries was what an incredible chronicler of heartache and heartbreak she was. And she was always out there, as it was. Well, you know, her personal life was as much of a war zone as the one she covered professionally.
You go all the way back to her being born in Queens and then raised in a very suburban Long Island life. But she went abroad as a teenager, and it seems that that trip changed her a bit. Can you share with us where she went and the effect it had on her?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, so she was born in Queens, but she was brought up in East Norwich near Oyster Bay in Long Island. And it was, you know, she was the eldest of five children, a very Catholic family. But, you know, I think even before she went abroad, you can see the seeds of rebellion. Mm-hmm. And one of the quotes from her diary that I like best, I found her in her mother's basement. I found her teenage diaries. And there's one from when she's 13 years old and the family all have to go to mass on Sunday. And she writes very simply, to church, war mini. The mother and the father know like. And I thought, oh, I know that naughty girl. I know the brave woman she became. But you were referring to, yes, she was very, very bright. I mean, that's another sort of aspect of Marie, that she was rebellious and she was willful in some ways, and some would argue reckless, but she always studied. She always came top at school, and you could see that in her later journalism. But then she, you know, she just felt she couldn't carry on. She was bored in Oyster Bay. And she went to Brazil on an exchange program. And that, I think, was what gave her an absolute taste for travel, because she was just enchanted by how different it was, by the culture, by the language, by the different mores and different ways of doing things. And I think that was really what set in stone for her that she was going to travel. She was not going to stay in Long Island.
And it's very interesting in the book, there are photos. And one of the ones that you point out and that you write about is you show a picture of her before she went. She's sort of cherubic and sweet in a sweater. Yeah. And she comes back angular and much more sophisticated in all black. There'd been some sort of a transformation.
I love that. So, yeah, so she has these sort of long, you know, long Carole King curly curtains before she goes, sort of unstyled hair and this jumper, or what we would call jumper, mm-hmm. you'd call sweater. But then the mother of the family where she was staying was very sophisticated and elegant, and she straightened Marie's hair. And Marie looked around and saw all the Brazilian girls were much slimmer than her, so she went on a diet. And she just came back looking, well, one of her ex-boyfriends told me, oh, when she came back, she looked like a Brazilian babe. You know, she was just incredibly slim and sophisticated. And although, you know, she was this tough war correspondent, but that feminine side was also very much part of her. She was somebody who loved clothes. She always wrote about clothes, and she loved to party. After she lost the sight in her left eye, she had an eye patch studded with rhinestones, especially for parties.
We're speaking with Lindsay Hilsman about her new book, In Extremis, The Life and Death of War Correspondent Marie Colvin. Lindsay, was there one assignment that really was her breakthrough assignment?
Well, I think that in 1986, she got a visa for Libya just before Reagan bombed Libya, and she managed to get an interview with Colonel Gaddafi. Now, at that time, do you remember Reagan called him that mad dog of the Middle East? I mean, he was public enemy number one, and he was a strange and rather predatory, maverick character. People were very afraid of him. She got the interview partly because she was young and female, and so she really was, you know, dancing with the bear. It was dangerous. But he took to her, and he talked to her. And so she got this interview, which nobody else got. And it was a strange interview. He seemed to not know that his country was about to be bombed, which everybody else knew. But she got in, and she got the interview, and she got out intact. And that was really when she became well known.
You write in the book about the lack of female role models for young women foreign correspondents. You both were in this very male-dominated profession, and you called yourself the Thelma Louise of the press corps. But Marie did find a few when she was in Paris, I believe. Who were these women, and what did she learn from them?
Yeah, there was Flora Lewis, who was an older and very sophisticated journalist, I think, with the New York Times then. And what Marie used to say was that Flora taught her how to drink vodka martinis and how to get information out of sources at cocktail parties. And then she talked to her, you know, you have to remember what they said in the morning. That was more difficult. Aline Mosby, who's a fascinating character, who had been the United Press International Bureau chief. And she, you know, she had been in Russia. She had been all over the world. She, again, was incredibly sophisticated, which was something that appealed to Marie. But Marie also found role models in the journalists of World War II. So Martha Gellhorn, who, you know, like Marie, believed in getting the view from the ground. And John Hersey. Now, John Hersey taught her at Yale. He wrote that incredible book, Hiroshima, which Marie always said was the best book on war. And what that book does is it takes five people who survived the atomic bomb in Hiroshima, and it tells their stories. It weaves them together. And it's not about strategy. It's not really about politics. It's not about the weaponry. It's about the impact of the atomic bomb on individuals. And Marie's best friend in America, Katrina Herron, remembers Marie coming out of John Hersey's class and saying, that is what I want to do. Those are the kind of stories I want to tell. This is the way I want to be a journalist.
At the Sunday Times, she wrote a story in the late 80s about watching a young woman die after being shot by a sniper during a military siege of a Palestinian refugee camp in Beirut. How did she approach the story that made it stand out?
It was an extraordinary story. I mean, first of all, she and the photographer bribed a militiaman to hold fire for 1 minute so that they could run across the no man's land to get into the camp. Just think how dangerous that was. Mm. And then she saw this young woman who'd gone up what they used to call the path of death. The camp was besieged and the women were going out to get food. And she was shot by the militia on the way back in. And it was the first time Marie had seen anything like that. And there's another incredible photograph where you see her looking at this woman who's being treated in the makeshift hospital. And Marie has her hand over her mouth. She's never seen anything like it. But she wrote about Haji Ahmed Ali She wrote about the little gold earrings that she had and how shapely she looked once she'd been cleaned, and how she grasped in her clenched fist blood and dirt, and that was cleaned out. And, you know, what got her was that the earrings were very like a pair that she had bought for her younger sister, Kat. So the story really touched her, and she wrote it in a way that meant that everybody could relate to this young woman. She wasn't just some abstract, you know, refugee who you don't know who she is. You knew Haji Ahmed Ali, the 22-year-old girl who'd been shot. And that story had a huge impact. The militia was sponsored by the Syrian leader, Hafez al-Assad. He, in turn, was sponsored by Gorbachev. And it was the time when Gorbachev was trying to get in more with the West. And the Sunday Times was an influential newspaper. Within 3 days, the pressure, partly from that story, meant that the militia was pulled back and the siege of the camp was over. Marie thought, my journalism can have an impact. I can make a difference.
We're talking to Lindsay Hilsum about her new book, author of In Extremis, about correspondent Marie Colvin. And Lindsay, you early in the book, you foreshadowed that Marie had a drinking problem. I'm going to read a passage, and it's interesting to us here in New York because you're writing about a place that's about 5 blocks from the studio.
Oh, I think I know where.
Mickey and Marie would frequently down a bottle or two of wine at lunchtime. In the evening, Joe McDermott would join them, and the Three Musketeers would go to the Lion's Head, a dingy dive with a dark whiskey-colored wooden bar, conveniently located just across from Marie's new apartment and between the famous gay bar Stonewall and the offices of the Village Voice. The Lion's Head was a journalist pub. Its walls were decorated with jackets of books, many written by the clientele. The bathrooms were covered with graffiti. A plan to repaint sparked a popular rebellion. Known as an Irish pub for drinkers with a writing problem, it stayed open till all hours, so reporters from the New York Post, the Daily News and Newsdays, the news agencies, and a dozen other papers would show up whatever that time they came off shift. Marie was an instant hit there and became a regular, always surrounded by men drawn to her dynamism and her looks, and who soon learned that she could not only hold her own in any conversation, but also drink them under the table. Did her drinking affect her work?
Yes, at one point it did. I think not at that point. I have to say, when I was researching that, I was so jealous of her. I wished that I'd been in New York and had been drinking at the Lion's Head. It just sounded like such a cool place and such an extraordinary time in journalistic history and in the history of journalism in New York. Everybody used to go there. But later on, yes. I mean, Marie did, she did drink too much. And she later on, after she lost the sight in her eye, which was after she was shot while crossing a front line in Sri Lanka, you know, she had to face up then to the fragility of her body, but it took her a long time to face up to the fragility of her mind, and she self-medicated with alcohol. It was, you know, she was then treated for PTSD, and although she carried on drinking heavily, I used to work with her in the field, and she did not, you know, it did not stop her. You know, she was still a fantastic journalist. She was incredibly sober when she was out there doing the business. You know, she was remarkable always. But she did become thin and erratic, and back home, you know, I wrote that, you know, she was easy to love and hard to help. And a lot of her friends tried to stop her from drinking and, you know, get her to live a more healthy life. But, you know, that was a sort of compensation. And that was the way, I suppose it was the evidence that this brave, bold, glamorous war correspondent, which is what she was on the outside, she didn't always feel it inside. There was that disconnect, and I think that the drinking was something to do with that.
Yeah, a fellow female correspondent who knew her well said that, you know, in private she, this is a quote, Colvin was a wreck. Clear to those of us who knew her, she was haunted by debilitating nightmares and battlefield flashbacks. She chain smoked. She woke up screaming at night. Yet she never left. She never left her calling. Why not? If given it was so difficult for her personally.
Well, I think there's a couple of things. First of all, I think she really was committed to it. And I think that sometimes she was happier in the field. You know, you could, when you're out, you can postpone the difficult things in life, like, you know, dealing with your complicated relationship or the mortgage or the bills or any of that stuff. Everything, you know, normal life just, you know, is put in another bucket and you just don't worry about it. All there is the story. And there's a purity about that. And I think Marie loved that purity. I think she was utterly committed to telling the stories of victims of war, whether that was the women and children or the conscripts. And she really felt that to do that, you had to go in there. You couldn't stay on the margins. And I think that, you know, she also, you know, let's not turn Marie into a saint. You know, there was the normal journalistic competition. She wanted to be, you know, the best and to get the best story. So I think all of that. But I think it's important, you know, you quote that of her being a wreck. Yeah, I mean, I certainly saw her in times when she was a wreck. She wasn't like that all the time. And I suppose one of the things that I want to do in the book is remember how funny she was. You know, she was the best company on the road. She really was. And she would tell hilarious stories. She was a great raconteur. She had endless anecdotes. And people were drawn to her because she was just such fun to be with. And that never stopped.
For her last assignment, she was smuggled into Syria to report on a slaughter there. Why did she have to be smuggled in, first of all, and then how did and when did you learn that she had been killed?
Well, this was when the border from Lebanon, you couldn't get across it except by being smuggled, and Baba Amr, which was part of the city of Homs, was under siege. It was controlled by rebels, and the Syrian government was firing endless barrages of rockets into it. And it was at that time, February 2012, when what had been a peaceful uprising in Syria was turning into a civil war. And to get in, she and the photographer she was with, Paul Conroy, they had to go through more than a kilometer of a storm drain, like a sewer. I mean, they had to, you know, crawl in bent over. And when they came out the other end, they were being fired at. It was incredibly dangerous. She saw what they called the widow's basement, where the people were sheltering. And she came out and did an incredible story, which it gave the lie to what President Bashar al-Assad was saying, which was that the only people in the enclave were terrorists. Marie's story proved that these were civilians in there and they were being shot at, they were being targeted. But then what Marie did was she felt that she had abandoned the people of Baba Amr, and so she insisted on going back in. And she didn't tell her foreign editor, and she didn't tell me, she didn't tell anyone. And when she got back in, she then wanted to broadcast because she realized that the situation was so dangerous it couldn't wait for her Sunday newspaper deadline. So she called me on the phone, on Skype, on the satellite phone. And I was furious with her. I said, Marie, you know, why did you go back in? And she said, Lindsay, it's the worst we've ever seen. And I said, I know, but, you know, what's your exit strategy? And she said, that's just it. We haven't got one. We're working on it now. And about, well, several hours later, she was killed. A mortar came in, fired by the government, and it killed her and a young French photographer called Remy Oschlick.
It's an amazing story, well told. The name of the book is In Extremis, The Life and Death of War Correspondent Marie Colvin. My thanks to its author, Lindsay Hilsum. Thank you, Lindsay.
It's been a pleasure to talk to you.